right, Madam Chair, I think we are ready. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the October 22, 2020 Delta Stewardship Council meeting. I'm Susan Tatayan, Chair of the Council, and I do apologize for the late start. I downloaded the latest version of Zoom yesterday, and that led to my technical difficulties, so I apologize. Let's move on to agenda item 2, establish a quorum. Council members, please state your presence, alphabetical order, starting with Judge Damrell.
Damrell present.
Mike Gatto's here.
Aronian's here.
Yegas is present.
Singali is here.
And Tatayan is here. We have a quorum. Just a quick note to our listeners, if any member of the public is interested in providing public comment, please send an email blue card to the clerk at engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov as seen on the screen. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item that you wish to comment on. Also, please note if you wish to speak or would like the clerk to read your comment. When your name is called, the clerk will unmute your connection or read your comment if requested. Agenda item 3, we do not have a closed executive session today, we have established a quorum, so no need for a second roll call. That takes us to agenda item 6, the consent calendar. Are there any public comments on any items on the consent calendar?
It looks like Karen is requesting to present. Let me get this cleared up. I believe it might be on the second consent calendar item. One second.
Alita, I think she's available to answer questions should there be questions, but there's not a formal presentation.
All right, sorry, I'm just reading off of my comments request. Let me just double check really quick.
You can also use the raise hand feature.
Yeah, Alita, it looks like it's only if needed.
Okay, I think we can move on then.
Okay, if there are no public comments, members, is there any discussion on any items on the consent calendar?
Madam Chair, if there are no comments, Vegas would move that consent.
Okay. Hearing no comments, and Oscar Vegas has moved to approve the consent calendar. I think this was
second.
Oh, and was that Judge Damrell with a second?
Yes, second.
Okay. Let's move to the vote then, starting with Judge Damrell.
Damrell, aye.
Gatto, aye.
Aronian, aye.
Vegas, aye.
Zingali, aye.
And Tatayan, aye. Consent calendar is approved. On to the chair's report, agenda item 7. For agenda item 7, Amanda Bull will give us a brief update on upcoming DPIC and the Science Needs Assessment Workshop.
Great. Thank you, Chair Tatayan, and good morning, council members. Can everyone hear me okay before I get going?
Yep.
Okay, great. I'm happy to be here this morning to provide you with an overview of Monday's Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting. And while doing this, I'll also provide you, excuse my doorbell, I'll also provide you with just a bit of an update on how the recent Science Needs Assessment Workshop went. last week. So for DPIC, we've crafted an agenda focused on climate resilience. And during this meeting, we're going to explore this theme via two agenda items. So the first is an update of the recent Science Needs Assessment Workshop, which is one of the three priority actions that DPIC endorsed at its November 2019 meeting to achieve ongoing, consistent, and reliable science funding. The workshop occurred October 5th and 6th. We had close to 150 participants who considered two questions through two half days of breakout groups. The first question was, what do we need to know to support future decisions? And the second, how do we develop a structure to support, encourage, and accomplish our science needs? So we'll have the chair of the Delta Independent Science Board, Steve Brandt, and the U.S. Geological Survey's Mike Jakowski at DPIC to present outcomes of the workshop and next steps. The plan is to have a draft science needs assessment document available for review by the end of this year, and then have a final document ready early 2021. Dr. Larson also included a short write-up of the workshop in today's Lead Scientist Report, so you can also reference that, and I believe she'll be mentioning it as well during her verbal report. The DPIC meeting's second agenda item will highlight Bay Delta climate change initiatives and the governor's recent nature-based solutions executive order. The council's Jeff Henderson and Harriet Ross will preview initial findings from Delta Adapts. Jessica Fain, the planning director from the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, will provide an update on the Bay Adapt effort to establish a regional agreement on adaptation strategies in the Bay. And then Amanda Hansen, Deputy Secretary for Climate at the Resources Agency, will address Governor Newsom's high priority efforts around climate change. And during and following these presentations, there will be opportunities for DPIC members to discuss how to leverage and align these regional initiatives with statewide efforts. So I know I'm looking forward to a very dialogue-rich DPIC meeting on Monday. I hope some of you are able to join us and to listen in and participate. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about the DPIC agenda and meeting, as well as the Science Needs Assessment Workshop.
Thank you, Amanda. Council members, are there any questions for Amanda? Okay, is there any public comment on this item?
No public comment.
Great, thank you. Let's move on to agenda item 8, Executive Officer's Report with Jessica Pearson.
Good morning, council members and members of the public. For anyone who's new to our meetings or who hasn't attended in a while, just a brief announcement that due to the pandemic, the council has been holding all public meetings online. Our staff are mostly working from home, but remain able to assist the public. And if anyone needs to contact staff at the council at any time, please email hello@deltacouncil.ca.gov to be connected to the appropriate staff person. I also encourage anyone who's interested in following our activities to sign up for our listserv and regularly check our websites for updates. The council sent out two comment letters this month. Both are available in your packet and on the web. The first letter is to the City of Tracy regarding a notice of preparation of an environmental impact report for what's called the Tracy Alliance Project. The project aims to develop over 3 million square feet of warehouse space on agricultural land within the City of Tracy's sphere of influence. Some of the project's area would also be reserved to accommodate a planned freeway interchange. Comment letter focuses on the project's potential status as a covered action. We cite the applicable Delta Plan policies and the potential growth impacts of the project for the Delta. In addition, the letter raises concerns regarding the potential environmental justice impacts of the project, particularly truck traffic, upon the incorporated town of Banta, which already shoulders a heavy pollution burden. So as usual, the letter invites the project proponent to engage in early consultation with council staff, and council staff can keep you updated on the project as it progresses. The council's second letter was to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers regarding their notice of intent to prepare an environmental review, or an EIS, for the proposed Delta Conveyance Project. Because the proposed project would alter federal levees and cause other impacts to U.S. waterways, permission from the Army Corps of Engineers is required. The letter to the Army Corps provides the Council's recent comment letter that we sent to the Department of Water Resources on the project, And it reiterates that the project appears to be a covered action and therefore encourages close coordination between the Army Corps and DWR in order to ensure consistency with the Delta Plan. The applicability of various Delta Plan policies to the project is described, and for more details, I'd refer you to the letter. Also, we're available to answer any questions. Jeff Henderson on my staff can provide more details at any time. The outreach highlights report, the full active projects list, and this month, the quarterly contract report are available as part of your board packet and also on the web. We have no legal update today, and as the legislature is not in session, no legislative update. So I will just look ahead to the rest of today's agenda. On today's agenda, we've invited Delta Watermaster Michael George to report on his office's recent activities of interest related to the Delta Plan. We also, in honor of Flood Preparedness Week, the new Department of Water Resources Chief of the Division of Multi-Benefit Initiative, Steve Rothert, will describe future plans for his division and the department related to Delta levies. And with that, I conclude my report. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jessica.
Jessica, this is not a comment on your report, but I just wanted to make the mention of the staff and their work, which I think is extraordinary. Mike and I and Maria sat in on a climate assessment hour yesterday, and I was kind of bowled over by the extraordinary lengths the assessment was made and what was being done. I just had never expected that, and I was very impressed. But more importantly, I think it's important to note that the staff is working oftentimes with small children in the house, and somehow this work is getting done with extraordinary effort on the part of the staff. So whether Jessica, Bethany, and your entire staff, I just want to thank you for what you're doing, what the staff is doing, which I think is amazing under the circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Judge.
Thank you, Judge. Yes, we do have kindergarten and third grade happening at the same time as a council meeting, and it's working.
Yeah, and I know I've said this before, but I want to echo that. I mean, somehow very complicated work keeps getting done very well, and it's a challenge for everybody, you know, during these times, and I know how hard it is for many of you. So just from all of us on the council, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. That's nice to hear. It's good to hear. We do have staff who are really turning out incredible work during these extraordinary times, and there aren't as many opportunities to get kudos or recognition, even though, you know, I get the benefit every day of seeing the quality of the work. So it's nice to hear those words, and we appreciate it. And
oh, yeah.
Committed to keep delivering on that level.
Yes, and we'll make sure to share your gratitude with our staff as well. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Judge, for mentioning the climate work. That's something that's going to be the topic of discussion at both the November and especially the December council meetings. We're excited to finally get to a point where we can share more details and the preliminary findings. But for those of you who are very much interested in a preview of that work, the October DPIC meeting on Monday at 1 o'clock is the opportunity to hear a brief presentation of our preliminary findings. So I hope people tune into that. Thank you. And I'll turn it back to you, Chair Tatayan.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, Council Members Demrell and Gatto, for taking the time to recognize the excellent, outstanding work of Stewardship Council staff. I agree completely. Given these times and the conditions, it's truly amazing. The quality of work continues to be very high and productive. So let's move on to agenda item 9, the lead scientist report with Dr. Laurel Larson, our lead scientist. Is Laurel on?
Chair Tatayan, I'm not seeing her on the list or in the attendee section at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, it's, I'm imagining difficult from Finland. So she's not waiting in the lobby, or I'm just double checking.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at it. I'm not seeing her there.
Okay.
Maybe we might want to possibly move on to a different item and we can come back maybe.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. Thank you, Brandon. Well, in that case, let's move on to agenda item. Did I hear someone click on? No? Okay, on to agenda item 10, Delta Watermaster update with Michael Patrick George, our Delta Watermaster.
That one, I'm not seeing him on yet either, because I think we told him 9:30, so it should be on any minute. But we do have the next one, Steve Rothard, on if we want to move on to that item. Apologies about that, Chair Tatayan.
Okay. At the beep I just heard, it's not Michael George.
No, well,
I'm sorry.
If Steve is here, we're happy to move on to item 11. Take it a little out of order with the chair's permission.
Sure, yeah. Is Steve on?
Yep, I'm moving him over right now.
Okay.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Good morning, Steve. Yes.
Let me just correct my own sound here and turn off my call. Good. Well, good morning, Chair Tatayan and council members. I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning and talk about my vision for the Division of Multiple Benefit Initiatives, which I became the chief of just in the middle of June, just 4 months ago or so. And I also wanted to point out that Robert Charney is with us this morning as well, and I think you might be able to see him on your screen. Robert is the chief of the branch in our division, in my division, that focuses, prioritizes the Delta Levy system. So his branch is the Delta Levy Systems Integrity and Delta Habitat Restoration Branch. And because I am so new to this position and DWR, I wanted to have Robert join us in case there are questions that stump me with my limited experience and knowledge of the program. So thank you, Robert, for joining us. What I want to do this morning is talk with you about what I bring to this position from my previous professional experience, what my vision is for the division's work in the Delta, and how I would like my division and frankly the rest of DWR to work successfully and effectively with the Stewardship Council and staff. So I appreciate the opportunity to address you all on these topics. So as I mentioned, I came to the DWR in mid-June after about 20 years leading the California Office of American Rivers, a national river restoration nonprofit. And in the last 2 years, I spent the majority of my time as the California director working on the negotiations to develop voluntary agreements for the water quality control plan update that the board is going through. And what I learned from that experience in particular, and also previous experiences, is just the importance of understanding the different perspectives that different stakeholders bring to any issues, and the value of making connections with people to build trust in order to jointly develop solutions that are effective and durable over time. And from a broad perspective, I have really come to embrace the The four societal goals that the Department of Water Resources developed and incorporated in the conservation strategy that was part of the flood plan update in 2017. And those four societal goals are public safety, ecosystem health, stable economies, and enriching life experiences. And I would add to the fourth principle of enriching life experiences, the principles of equity and justice, just given everything that's been happening across our country, that I think it's important to acknowledge those as important values to pursue in California. And so with that general background and perspective, my vision for the division, in particular the Delta region and the branch that Robert leads, the Delta Levee and System Integrity and Delta Habitat Restoration Branch, is to implement our work in the framework of those societal goals and in a way that can be as supportive and consistent with the Delta Stewardship Council priority and priorities of other key stakeholders in the Delta. So it's based on the recognition that the Delta is not just the hub of the state's critical water supply system, but also the hub of the Sacramento San Joaquin aquatic ecosystem and important infrastructure, as well as home to many communities and businesses that that need to be protected. And my goal is to accomplish our legal requirements to maintain the Delta levees and resources that we have in a way that enhances the ecosystem and quality of life and helps put the region on a more sustainable path with the threats of sea level rise and increased flooding that is at the core of the Stewardship Council's Delta Adapts program. Also, I'm committed to bringing as much transparency and accountability to the work that we do, my division and DWR in general, as possible. So those are the principles and pieces of the vision that I bring to this role. So as I mentioned, my division's approach to investing and working in the Delta is to be consistent with and supportive of the Delta Stewardship Council's priorities. And just to go a little bit further into the work that we do, there are two key branches that focus exclusively on the Delta and flood-related issues. The System-Wide Multi-Benefit Initiatives Branch, and that's the branch that updates the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan and also implements system-wide large flood projects that benefit public safety and also ecosystem values in the Delta. And the other branch that I'll focus more on is the Delta Levee System Integrity and Delta Habitat Restoration Branch, which is Robert's branch. And there are three parts to that branch. The subventions program, which is an annual and routine maintenance and repair support program where we provide grants to the reclamation districts throughout the Delta. And it's based on a first-come, first-served basis. The second part of this branch is the special projects branch, which is a competitive grant program that we implement on an occasional basis when we have adequate funding through a project solicitation package. And we don't now have enough funding available to put out a proposal solicitation package for these special projects because of the budget problem. But we hope to have adequate funding to do that down the road. And these special projects are generally larger in nature, much more expensive and more complex. And so we have a PSP package, the guidelines and all of that ready to go. We just don't have the funding to put it out to the public for applicants. And so, you know, we want to work with the Delta Stewardship Council and other leaders and stakeholders in the Delta to make the most strategic investments driven by priorities, but also being opportunistic when necessary and possible. And I understand that Robert's branch and others within the Department of Water Resources are working on a memorandum of understanding that sets forth how DWR and the Stewardship Council, as well as the Flood Protection Board, will work together to help the Delta Stewardship Council use its priorities to inform the decisions of the Department of Water Resources and the Flood Board and the investments that it makes in the Delta. And our attorneys and staff are working through that MOU now, and maybe Susan or Robert can provide a more detailed sense of when we expect to complete that memorandum of understanding. I'm becoming familiar with the Delta ADAPTS program, and I understand that I believe you're still in the first phase of that program, conducting the vulnerability assessment, and then the second phase will be the adaptation strategy. And I look forward to working with Susan and you all and staff to better understand that program and understand the role that we can play in achieving the goals of that program. And finally, before I give you folks a chance to ask some questions, I just want to stress again that my strong belief in the importance of a good partnership between the Stewardship Council and DWR, that I plan to support our staff in my division and elsewhere in developing and strengthening those connections and working relationships. And I would invite the council members, you all, and your staff to contact me directly if you feel you need to with any issue or concern that you might want to discuss. And I will, as Susan and I were talking about last week, I will feel she was invited me to always reach out to her if I have an issue to bring to her to discuss. Mm-hmm. So with that, I will end my remarks and happy to discuss any question or issue that you folks would like to bring up. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
I have a couple of questions. Go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead, Judge.
Steve, you mentioned funding or the lack thereof. What does the future funding of this Delta Levy program look like?
Well, Robert can provide more details, but we have, as I said, there's funding for there are the different components of the program. There's the Delta Levy Subvention Program, and we have adequate funding to continue that program for about a year and a half. So through the middle of 2023, if I'm correct, and nod your head, Robert, if that's correct. More or less, it looks like. And then with the Delta Special Projects Program, that program is essentially, we have very little money in there in that account. We believe we need about $50 million to have a meaningful special projects program. And so we will be looking for some substantially more funding to implement that project. Robert, would you like to add anything to that response?
Yes, I would, Steve. The Delta Levies program is essentially at the tail end of a stream of funding. As most of you are probably aware, Proposition 1E pumped a lot of money into the Delta, as did Proposition 84 over the last 10 years or so. Those funds are essentially being exhausted. They're at the very tail end of what's left. We also have a little bit of funding from Proposition 1 that's we're using to finish projects that have been started over the last 10 years, because these projects take multiple years to be completed. What we don't have is money for new starts. So that's why, as Steve has said, we're not planning to put this PSP that's ready on the street. The funds we do have are necessary to finish what we've already started. And then as another priority, to make sure subventions continues for as long as we can continue, you know, as long as we can. On the horizon, as you surmise from what I've stated, we're proposition funded. We're not general funds funded, essentially. On the horizon is perhaps the climate resiliency bond that was originally scheduled for the November ballot was pulled. There may be funding in that if that goes through. But without that bond, it does look troubling 2 years or so out in terms of how we can continue the amazing progress that this program has made in the Delta. So that's what I would add.
Thanks, Robert.
Well, I have one more question, but I don't want to, others have questions, but they can proceed as well. Just give me an idea of how you incorporate climate change into your program decisions for flood risk reduction.
Robert, you're probably a better respondent to that question. You want to share your thoughts and to the judge?
I will. Climate change has been a part of our scoring criteria for the PSPs since about 2016. It may have even been a little earlier than that. The projects we do are locally driven. They're locally proposed to us. And then we evaluate those projects on their statewide benefit. And that's how we decide which ones, or at least historically, how we've decided which ones go forward. So the projects that are underway have climate change considerations in them. And typically that has been, I don't know if informal is the right word, but for example, we allow the local engineers to add a half a foot above their expected freeboard on the levees to account for subsidence and climate change and unknown factors. So they're reaching, they're building the levees using state and local funds to levee standards that are very protective. And for example, I don't want to get into too much detail, but PL 8499 and Bulletin 19282, these are levee standards that have that provide a great deal of protection and some accounting for climate change. And then we allow the engineers to add a little bit. Now, do we need to formalize that better? Yes, we do. As the climate science has been, you know, adapting, if you will, or changing, and we get new estimates all the time. We haven't been able to formalize it yet, but at some point down the road, we need to say, okay, this is how much freeboard we need to add to these levees to account for climate change. We just don't have that number formalized yet.
And I would add two pieces to that I think have some long-term promise that I'm excited about. And one is the projects that the department has been implementing on Sherman and Twitchell Island to demonstrate the greenhouse gas sequestration potential and soil building and reversing the subsidence capacity of wetland projects. And recently, the California Air Resources Board adopted these types of projects as official protocols for carbon credits in the voluntary market. They've been in place for some time now, and we expect those credits to be available on the compliance market, which can fetch a much better price per ton of carbon sequestered in wetlands. And we are looking to expand those projects as a potentially economically viable agricultural endeavor, or even a crop, if you will, for some of the lands throughout the Delta. We're also working with companies in a couple of places in the Delta considering to explore the deep storage of carbon. And hopefully, over time, those pilot projects will prove successful, and we will be able to support that kind of effort. So, of course, those are much longer term, but I think ultimately we'll have to be part of the solution, the broader solution going forward.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Chair Tatayan, are you still there? Might be on mute. Were there any other questions?
Hello?
From the members?
Oh. Hello? Can folks hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I guess you didn't hear me earlier. Anyway, Steve, I just wanted to say thank you so much. I do have a question on your thoughts about integrating the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan and the Delta Plan. I know that you haven't been on the job long, but just preliminary thoughts about possible points of integration.
That's a good question, Chair Tatayan, and I'm not, honestly, I haven't dived into the Delta Plan and the Flood Plan enough to have specific thoughts. But what I can say is that I and the team in the System-Wide Multi-Benefit Initiatives Branch, which is the team working on updating the Flood Plan, are in the process now of reaching out to key stakeholders in the geographic area that the flood plan covers to begin to get their recommendations and priorities and potential solutions to the flood problems that or flood challenges that we're facing. And that's a process of essentially integrating local and sort of sub-regional priorities and options into the broader Central Valley plan. And I think there should be, and I'm sure there is, an opportunity for us to work with Delta stakeholders in a similar way to ensure better integration of that. And so let me take that as a task to get back to you on, talk with my staff, better understand their process and the opportunities to integrate. And Robert, if you've got anything that you'd like to add, please share at this point, if you'd like.
Maybe just a quick thought. We have, there's recognized for a long time an overlap. And we've actually been talking in the branch chiefs meetings underneath Steve, that, you know, even though we've been working side by side for years, many years, and making sure that the objectives of the flood plan and the objectives of the Delta Levees program guided by the Delta plan are, again, side by side aligned, we're going to try to reach across the aisle to each other a little bit more and integrate closer. We haven't thought about, at least at the staff level, you know, what form that takes, if there's a piece of, if there's a change to the flood plan or a change to the Delta plan, to formalize that integration. But at least on the ground, we're working together even closer than ever before under Steve. Thank you.
Yes, you know, I have to say that this is really a terrific moment. I know how difficult it is to integrate across programs, having worked at Department of Water Resources and having in my past been an activist on the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan conservation strategy. And I want to congratulate the Department of Water Resources for taking this step, having you, Steve, as the division chief of the multiple benefit initiatives. This is really exciting to see something that many folks have been wanting for a long time, to see the public safety flood folks working with the levees program and working with other divisions in the department. So I want to congratulate you, and I'm really excited about your coming efforts. One suggestion I do have is the conservation strategy for the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan. I think, I don't know for a fact, I haven't had a chance to review the current conservation strategy for the flood plan and walk it across our ecosystem amendment of the Delta Plan, along with our Delta Adapts effort. But I think there are possible points of integration on all three of those fronts, and it would be terrific, Steve, to work with you in the future on discovering the points of integration and pursuing them.
Chair Tatai, and this is Robert Charney again. Steve has sent me a note that he was disconnected and is trying to reconnect. I will make sure that your suggestion is carried forward, and I have no doubt he will agree.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Well, this has been a morning of technical challenges. So, council members, if there are no other questions for Steve or Robert, I'll ask, Lita, are there any public comments?
Yes, we have Gil Cosio that would like to make a public comment.
Okay.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Gil.
Hi, Susan, President Tatayan and Stewardship Council. I just wanted to make a quick comment, kind of endorsing what Robert and Steve have just reported on. First of all, you know, the fact that we've got these two guys on board is fantastic. As you know, they work under Chris Trunell, Deputy Director Trunell, and for a long time he was a lone ranger, and poor guy had to struggle with trying to manage all the way down to the levees program. But now that Steve and Robert are on board, we're kind of in motion now to kind of get things moving. I wanted to address a couple of questions that the board had, or the council had. First, Judge Damrell, we do look at climate change. We've long established what it's going to take to keep these levees stable under sea level rise and climate change. And we're also working with your Delta Adapts group. I have to applaud Aaron Mullen and Andrew Schwartz for reaching out to some of the locals to kind of get our feedback on the Delta Adapts. So we're kind of working side by side on that. So we're staying on top of the climate change and sea level rise issues. As far as the State Plan of Flood Control Conservation Strategy, President Tatayan, our districts are part of the Lower Sac Delta North Regional Flood Management Group. And so there are projects that are in the Regional Flood Management that do affect the Delta levees. And so we're keeping up with that group to make sure that our projects, especially the ones that protect the small communities in the Delta, are in the queue in case money becomes available, or whatever the case may be as far as implementation of that plan. So we're excited that, you know, you've got a full staff now. Stewardship Council staff's reaching out to us, and I think we're working together. And like Robert said, these projects are driven by the locals, so it's a good partnership. And I think we're feeling a lot more comfortable now with the staff that we have in place. So thank you.
Thank you, Gil. Great news. Are there any other public comments on this item?
No, that was the last one.
Okay, thank you, Lita. Well, then let's return to agenda item 9, the lead scientist report with Dr. Laurel Larson.
Thank you, Chair Tatayan and council members. It's great to be here before you all today. Thanks to Steve before me for giving a really interesting and inspiring presentation. I'm looking forward to meeting you and working with you in person. Today, I'm going to start the lead scientist report by spotlighting an article that recently came out in San Francisco Estuary and Watershed Science by Dylan Stomp, Peter Moyle, Avery Kruger, and John Durand at the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. The title of the article is Comparing and Integrating Fish Surveys in the San Francisco Estuary, Why Diverse Long-Term Monitoring Programs Are Important. Now, one of the actions identified in the 2016 to 2021 Science Action Agenda is capitalizing on existing data through increasing science synthesis in order to address knowledge gaps and identify phenomena that span large spatial or long temporal scales. Also, the Delta Science Program's draft proposal solicitation, which I'm delighted to announce is just out for comment 2 days ago, also highlights science synthesis as an important priority. Last month, my article spotlight highlighted lessons learned from the recent drought, which involved synthesis of several types of data sets. And next month's spotlight will also likewise leverage several different types of data sets to draw conclusions about how Delta fish populations were impacted by the last several droughts. So there's a theme of science synthesis across these few reports. Across all of the synthesis studies and all of the potential studies that we might fund, there are several salient challenges associated with synthesis activities. First of all, different data sets that monitor the same species, for example, might employ different approaches, occur at different frequencies, or target dramatically different parts of the estuary. So are the consequent differences detected in these different data sets simply reflective of the underlying methodology, or are they representative of actual differences in processes? This is a challenge that scientists need to be able to tease out. The study that I'm spotlighting today took a critical look at this question as it pertains to long-term fish monitoring data in the San Francisco estuary and the Delta. The authors compared 14 different long-term fish monitoring surveys within the Delta. And these efforts in turn benefited from the Interagency Ecological Program's recent efforts to make these data sets more transparent and easily accessible. Excuse me. The surveys were also compared to salvage data from the State Water Project and Central Valley Project, which is an often overlooked but potentially very rich rich data set for documenting trends in fish abundance. The salvage data set, in case you're not familiar with it, originates from fish that are entrained into the diversion before they're trucked daily and released at sites in the Western Delta. So these are fish that are almost accidentally caught, but it provides a data source that's available on a daily frequency. Now, the authors also performed an intensive analysis on four fish species, including the Delta smelt, longfin smelt, striped bass, and threadfin shad, that are known to have been strongly impacted by the pelagic organism decline. So there's a few findings from this review that I would like to highlight. First of all, and perhaps not surprisingly, the authors found that all individual data sets are biased in one way or another, with some species better represented in some of the data sets than others. Secondly, something that perhaps wasn't expected is that pelagic species, or species that dwell in open water parts of the estuary, were much better represented across all of the surveys than bottom-dwelling fish species or fish species that occupy the margins of the delta, both those associated with submersed aquatic vegetation and those not associated with submersed aquatic vegetation. Many of these fish species are abundant in the southern and central delta, and the authors concluded that these parts of the delta on whole are inadequately sampled, which leads to poor sampling of certain species like the largemouth bass. Going back to the difference between the salvage data set and these official monitoring data sets, interestingly, they found that the difference between these types of data sets was no more than the difference among the official fish monitoring data sets. However, the authors urged that differences between the Central Valley Project salvage and the State Water Project salvage should be interpreted with caution because those two data sets are not necessarily complementary to each other. They also found that long-term studies should not rely on any single data set. Across all of these data sets, no single data set was able to capture all of the known trends in species abundance. For instance, pelagic organism decline itself was very muted in one data set known as the Aggregated 8 Survey Index data set. So it's really important in these synthesis studies to account to use multiple types of long-term monitoring data sets and not just rely on any single one. So in terms of takeaways for the council, this study is important because it provides guidance for other projects attempting science synthesis. It provides some insight into best practices in performing science synthesis. And it also really emphasizes the importance of agencies like the Delta Stewardship Council continuing to support a diverse set of data collection efforts over long periods of time. So I will be happy to entertain questions about that article in the Q&A session, but we'll continue this discussion of synthesis as applied to fish species in the next lead scientist report. So now I'm going to transition into reporting on some of the recent activities of the Delta Science Program. And as many of you know, it's been a really busy and productive month for us in the DSP, particularly with respect to workshops. Now, last time I reported on some of the outcomes of the Sacramento River Drainage Spring Run Chinook Salmon Workshop, which was held September 8th through 10th. And just as a reminder, that workshop focused on identifying the best available science, knowledge gaps, and methodology relevant to developing a juvenile production estimate for spring run Chinook salmon, which is required as part of the Department of Water Resources' new incidental take permit for the State Water Project. Eva Bush has now provided an official report out in your packet. And some important updates in that report out are that a recording of the workshop is now available online and a workshop summary report will be available in November. So keep an eye out for that. The next workshop that was held after that, which I did not report on last time, was the Greenhouse Gas and Sediment Science Workshop, which was held September 17th. This workshop has huge relevance to the mandates governing both the Delta Science Council and the Delta Stewardship Council and the Delta Science Program. It brought together scientists and managers who are working on issues related to greenhouse gas monitoring using flux towers, for example, and sediment and marsh accretion in the Delta and Sassoon Marsh. These two topics are related and have high potential to inform each other, but they're often not talked about in the same context, and relevant researchers and managers have not previously had a space dedicated to discussing their projects together. In particular, these topics both have major implications for understanding the role of wetlands and other ecosystems in mitigating and responding to climate change and sea level rise, which has implications for the Delta Stewardship Council's Climate Change Vulnerability Assessment and Adaptation Strategy, otherwise known as Delta ADAPTS. Further science being generated on this topic is essential for informing and further developing the Delta Plan performance measure for subsidence reversal. So I'd also like to point out that opportunities for managers to get a glimpse into ongoing projects and the latest science are rare, and this workshop supported science-based management decisions through more effective interactions between scientists and decision makers. Dylan Chappell, one of the workshop organizers, would like to point out that the work being done on carbon sequestration and subsidence reversal, such as the Twitchell Island project, is in fact one of the best examples of adaptive management that's been happening in the Delta on a multi-decadal timescale. Keep an eye out for a special session among this group of scientists and managers at the upcoming Bay Delta Science Conference in April, which I'll talk about a little bit later in this report. But that's going to be the next venue in which they continue the conversation that was started at that workshop. Another workshop that has been extremely high profile took place on September 29th. It's the Science Action Agenda Management Questions Workshop. Over 85 participants from 12 federal and 51 state agencies, 4 academic institutions and 7 NGOs and consulting groups, as well as 12 water agencies, came together to discuss, edit, and prioritize a list of over 1,100 management questions for the San Francisco San Joaquin Delta. So these 1,100 management questions had already undergone some level of synthesis from 1,200 questions that staff of the Delta Science Program had originally gathered by reaching out to managers and scientists within this field to ask them about their most salient priorities for management of the Delta over the next 5 years. The breakout sessions at the workshop were facilitated by staff in the Science and Planning Division, who all did an exceptional job. The Delta Science Program is now hard at work incorporating the feedback from participants at the workshop, and in the weeks leading up to the workshop as well, they're also gathering additional input, and they hope to circulate a list of top Delta management questions later this fall that have been distilled to a much smaller number. A subset of these questions will in turn be selected for incorporation into the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda. And this will ensure that the update to the Science Action Agenda is relevant to existing management, supported by members of the Delta Science community and integrated with other planning efforts, including outcomes of the Science Needs Assessment Workshop, which I'll talk about next. We're encouraged by the tremendous engagement in this effort thus far, and we really look forward to continued collaboration in the development of the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda. And I'll just remind you that this was a new process that we went through this time around, reaching out to the community to identify these top management questions and priorities. The final workshop that took place since our last lead scientist report that I'll report on is the Science Needs Assessment Workshop. And again, just as a reminder, the Science Needs Assessment is focused on long-term planning for climate change, planning for the need to rapidly respond to a variety of changing conditions in the Delta. And that planning horizon is longer in time scale than the planning horizon for the Science Action Agenda, although the two are certainly complementary. So as a reminder, the Delta Independent Science Board, in coordination with the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee, were the hosts of these of this workshop, which took place from October 5th to 6th. And we had over 130 participants from multiple agencies in this workshop. The workshop was structured to facilitate discussion around topical themes that were outlined in the Delta Plan. It opened with plenary remarks from Felicia Marcus, who's the former chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, Peter Goodwin, former Delta lead scientist, and Ernest Conant, who's the regional director for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. These plenary talks provided considerable inspiration for the rest of the workshop, and one of the ideas that generated a lot of excitement was Peter Goodwin's proposal to establish a Delta Collaboratory. So this is something that was a focus of many of the breakout sessions that followed the plenary remarks and is an idea that we're continuing to develop within the Delta Science Program in coordination with the community. During the first day of the workshop, participants considered the science needs that will prepare Delta stakeholders for oncoming environmental changes. And then on the second and final day of the workshop, the discussion was more focused on the structure and also possible restructuring of Delta science governance. This workshop was a great opportunity for Delta stakeholders to provide input for the development of a long-term science strategy in the Delta, the science needs assessment. And we plan to release this report in early 2021. So this is something that I'll have further communication about as time progresses. We also have a lot of exciting events coming up that I'd like to put on your radar. And the first one that I'm going to talk about is something that I could use all of your help in spreading the word about and helping us promote. And this is our proposal solicitation notice. One of the most important things that the Delta Science Program does is to galvanize and oversee funding of relevant and timely science research that underpins our management of the Delta. We're gearing up to solicit our next round of research proposals. So we are trying to reach out to as broad a community as possible to solicit a very strong pool of proposals. The Delta Stewardship Council's Delta Science Program, in coordination with the Bureau of Reclamation, has drafted a proposal solicitation notice for this next funding cycle. The notice solicits scientific research proposals in two different categories. First of all, are focused research awards, which are similar to the type of awards that were solicited the last time around. And then the second category is integrated socio-ecological systems awards, which is a new category for this proposal solicitation. The integrated socio-ecological systems awards are larger and more integrative in scope than the standard research awards, but both types of projects must address one or more management challenges, demonstrate benefits to vulnerable communities in the Delta, and be directly relevant to the science action agenda. And one of the things that I've talked to several of the council members about in our one-on-one meetings recently is that the proposers are explicitly instructed to use the Delta Adapts Map tool, which is a new tool that just was released in the past month, in order to identify the locations of vulnerable communities within the Delta that will be impacted by their research. And they're instructed to explicitly state how their projects will impact those communities. We anticipate awarding up to $9 million in funding for 12 to 31 month projects, with up to $5.5 million coming from the Delta Stewardship Council and the remaining $3.5 million coming from the Bureau of Reclamation. The draft proposal solicitation notice is now out for public comment as of 2 days ago, with comments due by 5 p.m. on November 2nd. We anticipate publication of the solicitation notice in its final form on November 9th. Another new feature of this proposal solicitation is that we're requiring proposers to submit a letter of intent, and the deadline for that this year will be December 15th, with the proposals then due on February 12th of 2021. We just launched a major communications campaign to help us spread word about this funding activity, and we're targeting both specific researchers within the Delta, as well as the broader national and even international community. And I'm happy to report that I've already received some inquiries from Canada. We've been advertising through listservs, national professional organizations, and sister research communities in places like the Everglades, Louisiana, Chesapeake Bay, Great Lakes, and Puget Sound. So please do help us spread the word about this exciting opportunity. Another important thing that I'd like to put on your radar is the 2021 Bay Delta Science Conference, which is in the new year, but still rapidly approaching. This is our biennial forum for presenting technical analyses and results relevant to the Delta Science Program's mission to provide the best possible, unbiased, science-based information for water and environmental decision-making in the Bay Delta system. Next year, the conference will be held on April 6th through 9th, and it will be fully virtual. And one of the silver linings of that is that registration will be free. And so we are excited about trying to reach out to a broader community than is usually able to attend this conference, and hope that they will be able to take advantage of this free registration. I will also report that the conference will be joint this year with the Interagency Ecological Program Workshop, which will take the form of a dedicated track within the Bay Delta Science Conference. The chairs of the conference are Stacy Sherman from CDFW and Richard Conan from UC Davis. I'm also quite excited about this year's conference theme, which is building resilience through diversity in science. As the Bay Delta community works towards a goal of one Delta, one science by building resilience in our ecosystem, our institutions, and our collective science enterprise, promoting diversity in its many facets plays a central role. This includes biological diversity, genetic diversity, and diversity of the researchers who are participating in the science enterprise. This year's theme recognizes that true integration of this scientific and human diversity in the Bay Delta is a work in progress, but that charting pathways to get there is essential to build a more resilient water supply. So the abstract deadline is coming up in the next month. It's November 23rd, 2020. And one thing I should mention is that in addition to soliciting abstracts, we're also soliciting proposals for oral or poster special sessions. And you could find the website on the Delta Stewardship Council's website, and Maven's Notebook also recently published the call for abstracts. Just a couple of other quick things I want to bring to the forefront for this On Your Radar section. One is that many members of the Delta Science Program has been involved in producing a special issue of Frontiers for Young Minds, which is a publication of the prestigious Frontiers set of journals. It's a leading open access publisher and open science program. Frontiers for Young Minds publishes science for kids, edited by kids. And the special session that a large group of scientists in the Delta have been contributing to is called Where the River Meets the Ocean, Stories from the San Francisco Estuary. This includes Ted Flynn, who's serving as one of the editors. He's one of our newer hires within the Delta Science Program. The articles were submitted in early October, and they're now in peer review. So stay tuned for this exciting outreach project, and I hope that you'll pass on this issue to the young people in your life when it comes out. The final thing I'd like to mention is that the Zooplankton Ecology Symposium is coming up October 27th through 28th next week. This will be a virtual symposium featuring the latest research on zooplankton ecology and monitoring. It will be a two-day period with talks and panel discussions focusing on the San Francisco estuary, as well as work from other systems. We're targeting scientists, resource managers, and members of the public. And the content of the symposium includes zooplankton biology and ecology, information about current monitoring programs, emerging methods for data collection, and the IEP's integrated zooplankton data set. There will also be a panel discussion on data synthesis as a part of that workshop. The Delta Science Program is organizing that workshop in collaboration with the IEP and also the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the California Department of Water Resources. And again, registration for this workshop is free. So finally, there's a few numbers I'd like to report out on in the By the Numbers section. And again, you could refer to more details in the packet that Byron Riggins prepared for you all. First of all, I'd like to highlight that the Delta Science Program itself has been compiling some of its own statistics. We recently compiled a list of peer-reviewed publications that the staff have authored in 2020. By and large, this is outside of their official duties and is work that they're doing on their own free time. And I'd like to point out that they have been quite productive in research. The list includes 21 journal articles with 4 additional articles in review, 3 published data sets that were published as a part of their official duties, and 2 apps in Shiny. And these apps enable other researchers to more easily access data sets within the Delta. Details are going to appear in the Council annual report. And then finally, in terms of water temperatures and flow within the state of California, I'll just report that water temperatures are slightly warmer than average at this time of year. And in general, reservoir storage is slightly lower than average. The Sacramento River at Freeport has slightly more flow than usual, but the San Joaquin River is really notable right now at only 31% of its 20-year flow, average flow for October. So with that, I will conclude this report, and I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Laurel. Council members, any questions for Dr. Larson?
Hi, this is Daniel. Thanks, that was terrific, and welcome again, Doctor. Can you just give a little more texture to the public communications campaign? That's exciting to me that we can be broadening the circle of folks who are aware of some of this work. So I'd just like to hear a little bit more, please.
With respect to the funding solicitation, is that what you're asking about?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I'm happy to report on that. So myself, in collaboration with John Calloway, Louise Conrad, and other members of the Delta Science Program staff, have been coming up with a strategy for disseminating information about this proposal solicitation. And we've identified a number of different professional listservs. So these typically target specific research, specific disciplinary research communities. For instance, ecologists frequent one of these listservs, geomorphologists frequent another. A number of us are also fellows from national and environmental scholarship and fellowship programs, such as the Switzer Environmental Fellows Program and the Morris K. Udall Program. And so we are sending messages to other alumni of those programs as well. We're additionally reaching out to a number of professional societies, including the Ecological Society of America, the Society for Wetland Scientists, SURF, the Estuarine Research Federation. And then we've identified a number of people in our own professional networks, people who have applied for funding through this program in the past. People we know of who are research leaders in some of the other ecosystems that I talked about, but also do research more broadly. Also people at local universities who have expertise relevant to some of these scientific challenges that we're facing here in the Delta. So it's actually quite a comprehensive list, and we've divided and conquered and have sent out a lot of personalized emails, but also emails to these general lists. It's also being advertised on Twitter and the Delta Council's other social media channels.
Outstanding. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I should say we're also reaching out to previous Delta Science Fellows as well. So almost everyone who has received funding from us in the past. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Laurel. Are there other comments, questions from other council members? Okay, hearing none, are there any public comments on agenda item 9?
There are no comments for item 9.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Larson. Good to hear your voice again.
Thank you, Chair Tatayan. And I apologize, I wasn't able to be there earlier.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. We've had a few challenges this morning. So I understand from Brandon that there is a remaining comment on agenda item 11, a public that's comment.
Right. That's right, for Ocean Reserve, if she could unmute herself and give her a comment for item 11.
Hi, this is Osha. Can you hear me?
Yes, good morning, Osha.
Good morning. Sorry, I didn't give staff enough lead time, I'm sure. Good morning. These comments are on behalf of local agencies of the North Delta, which is a coalition of reclamation and water districts in the Northern Delta. And I just I appreciated the presentation that Steve Rothert gave from the multi-benefit initiatives section at DWR, as well as Robert Charney. And I just wanted to add in with respect to multi-benefit flood control projects that, you know, going forward with respect to, you know, hopefully new funding in the future for continued flood control work in the Delta, which is so important to the communities, as well as the agriculture, and as well as the water supply system for the state, that it's important to keep in mind that multi-benefit does include protecting water supplies, highways, utilities, and other infrastructure. And there's been some discussions in the past, and I just kind of want to highlight for this group here, since we're talking about it, that, you know, those are multi-benefits. And certainly habitat benefits can sometimes be included in levy projects. They don't always make sense to include in individual levy projects. And, you know, since passage of SB 34 in 1988, the Central Valley Flood Control System has been meeting a net enhancement of the habitat standard for the system as a whole. And that's why, you know, in our view, it's not necessary nor feasible to include an ecosystem restoration component separately in every levee project. And, you know, this will come up again, I think, as we discuss the Delta Levee investment strategy as that gets reworked as well, because I think it's very important that these multi-benefit not be construed to only pertain to habitat, just because of, you know, in a lot of locations along sloughs and rivers, there's just not enough room to try to incorporate habitat without taking a lot of farmland and incurring a lot of extra expense. That doesn't mean that habitat isn't important. It's just a practicality consideration. So anyway, that was my comment. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, OSHA. So let's move to agenda item 10, Delta Water Master Update with Michael George.
Michael, can you hear us okay?
I can hear now.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. So I presume people can hear me. I just lost the connection when I was unmuted. But in any case, Chair Tatayan and members of the committee, I'm Michael George. I'm the Delta Water Master, and I'm delighted to be with you this morning to give you the regular quarterly update on our activities in the Office of the Delta Water Master. So let's go to the next slide. Kind of an overview, I'd like to very quickly touch on updates of things we've talked about in the past, kind of tell you where we are in our accomplishment along the lines of our 2020 work plan initiatives. But I want to do that very quickly because I'd like to spend most of the time that we have today taking a deeper dive on two issues that I think are really important. They're related to lots of other things that are going on in the Delta, including many of the issues that Dr. Larson mentioned on the science front and that Steve and Robert described in terms of multi-benefit projects. And those are how to estimate actual water use within the Delta. What water actually is used and what it's used for, I want to go deeper on that because it's become much more important to our thinking about the Delta and our managing the Delta in the face of current challenges and challenges that are over the horizon. And the other thing I'd like to take a deeper dive on is the policy of the state of reducing reliance on the Delta and how that comes into focus in certain circumstances that have come up recently. So that's kind of the overview. Let's move to the next slide and tick down some of the efforts that we're doing on the 2020 work plan. As I've indicated in the past, in terms of overall preparation for the next drought, because managing water use in the Delta becomes acute when the water supply is in shortage condition. And because we've had a relatively water year dry in the past, just ending in on September 30th, and as Dr. Larson mentioned, we're going into the current water year with a little bit warmer temperatures and a little bit lower reservoir storage, we are thinking always about preparing for next year if it's a drought. Well, having had a dry year in our background, the conditions that we've got now suggest that we need to be prepared in case we have another dry year. So the biggest thing that we've focused on since the last drought is improving our data analytics, our data accessibility, and the transparency of the information that we've got, much of which is reported to us by water users. And we're trying to do a better job of QAQCing that data and making it transparent so that it's useful not just for us in planning what we will do in the face of the next drought, but to make that data available so that water users and water managers can also profit from it, so they can predict better what we know and what we will do with what we know, and they can take that information and work it into their drought planning. And that obviously connects us to the next stage, which is outreach to those water users who report a lot of their information to us and who need to understand how we're using it and how we're trying to improve it and what role they have in helping us improve our data sets by better, more consistent, more timely reporting. And again, I'm happy to point out here that within the Delta, we have fewer delinquencies. In fact, we're at 100% water supply reporting in the Delta. The only outstanding water reports for the last water year that we do not yet have are only those where the water right itself has changed hands and the report of that change has not been reflected yet in our data systems. So that holds up the report. But by and large, we've got all the data in on a timely basis that we're now working through the QAQC process. The other thing I'm going to touch on very briefly is the alternative compliance plan. This is alternative method for complying with the regulations of the State Water Board, which were adopted to implement SB 88, the Delta measurement requirement. So all the diversions in the Delta under SB 88 and the implementing regulations are designed to be measured with a device, a meter, or with some other comparable method to give us a high degree of reliability. But as I've reported before, that high degree of reliability has been elusive. And over a four-year period, this Delta Measurement Experimentation Consortium, a voluntary ad hoc group of people within the Delta trying to figure out how to implement the measurement requirement, have come together and are proposing an alternative. That alternative plan of compliance, I'm pleased to say we had the most recent meeting of that group a week ago today, October 15th. And we made good progress in that meeting to begin the next phase in that process, which is to create the software connection tissue between our heritage report management system at the State Water Board and the kind of cutting edge OpenET system that is coming online to help us use computer analysis of satellite images to identify crop evapotranspiration at the field level. So this is an unprecedented attempt to take the long data series that we have in the report management system and correlate it with the cutting edge science of measuring crop ET through satellite imaging. So I'm pleased to say that we're making progress on that. That alternative plan of compliance is scheduled to be live and available by January 1, 2022. Next slide, please. The other ongoing work plan initiative that I'd like to touch on is on the next slide, and it's about addressing the deterioration in the Southern Delta. And as members of the council and staff know, this is a drum that I've been beating because we really are seeing shocking deterioration in both ecosystem function, flood resilience, water quality, as well as water supply. And these two images just give you two snapshots of what's going on. On the right, you see the invasive weeds. In fact, there are kind of three successive generations of weeds there. Kind of closest to the camera is last year's dead residual from water hyacinth. Just in front of that, you've got the greened up this year's water hyacinth. And just in front of that, you've got a combination of those patches of floating hyacinth in a sea of duckweed, and then only beyond that do you get to open water. On the left-hand side, you see another channel in the Southern Delta that is significantly degraded because of sedimentation. And the only thing, in addition to kind of keep shocking you with these pictures of what's happening in our Southern Delta, I do want to indicate that the voluntary ad hoc committee that has come together to identify the problem, to describe it to broader audiences, is now in the process of having just released a request for proposals for professional consultants to come in and assist this ad hoc group, funded by the ad hoc group voluntary contributions, to help us plan for the next phase, to tell us some of the size of the problem, some of the costs of moving the material, restoring these delta channels, putting that material in better places, probably for levee enhancement, and just to get a better handle on it so that we can plan for how we're going to attack this problem, how much it's going to cost, how we're going to manage that. So that's really all I want to say about the 2020 work plan initiatives. I'm happy to take a moment if there are any questions on any of these before I jump into the two issues that I want to take a deep dive on.
Council members, are there any questions for Michael George on any of the items he's mentioned?
Okay, hearing none, I'm going to jump into the next slide, please, which, again, the two issues are estimating actual water use and then implementing the state policy of reduced reliance on the Delta. So next slide, going to the first of these, estimating actual water use in the Delta. You first have to think about what are the water uses? How do you categorize them? Because measuring them or understanding them or coming to grips with them requires an understanding that there are different uses. So the most important one in terms of the managed water use in the Delta is crop evapotranspiration, the actual consumptive use of the crop and the evaporation of the water that's needed to make that transpiration water available to help the crop grow. So the picture on the right is kind of a typical processed tomato field. Obviously, that field requires water that the crop then evaporates and transpires in order to grow. Below that picture, on the left-hand side of the slide, is a good picture of general riparian vegetation, of which there's a lot in the Delta. This is more difficult to measure from the satellite because, as you can appreciate, the satellite can see the top level, the canopy level, but we know that there are other plants in that riparian area that is that are transpiring water at the same time. So getting a handle on that is a little bit more difficult, and particularly as we look forward to having more riparian habitat, as we look at ways of reconnecting floodplain and so forth, we're going to have to take account of the ET of that riparian vegetation. And then the slide on the lower right shows two kinds of water use. On the right, the open channel is evaporation from open water. We all recognize that there are a lot of open channels in the Delta, and from those channels, you get evaporation that's unavoidable and probably beneficial at some point. But you also get evaporation from invasive weeds. And here again, I'm showing a channel that is choked with hyacinth. And this is this year's hyacinth. And what's happening there is that this is a floating aquatic weed with most of its bulk below the surface of the water. That area is filtering fresh water. And then it's feeding it up to the top where it is ETing out into the atmosphere. And the scientific work on this is still preliminary, but on a preliminary basis, it appears that that hyacinth actually creates a wick up into the atmosphere that evaporates and transpires water at about six times the level of the open water. So if you think about it, the open water on the right evaporates at a natural basis, but that invasive weed on the left multiplies that loss of water to the system, loss of fresh water to the system, by six times. Next slide, please. Of course, there are other than crop water uses in the Delta. There's some domestic.
Sorry, before you move on to the next one, can we go back to that slide? I have a question.
Sure.
On one, is there a chance to have some approximate percentages of these uses? Like what percent, what is the most? Is it like the way that you listed them? Is it from highest use to the lowest, or you can give us any kind of a percentage?
So that's a great question, but it requires you to think about, do we want to talk about during a season, during a month, during a period of extreme water shortage, during a period when, for instance, Term 91 is in effect? Because in general, when there's lots of water in the system, most of this means a lot less. The reason we focus on it is because we're looking at what happens when water becomes very acute. Well, so
yeah, that's my question. When it's more acute, yeah.
So the largest managed water use in the Delta is for crop ET during the summer, during the growing season. The second largest is the combination of riparian vegetation ET and open water evaporation. The fastest growing and the most concerning for a variety of reasons is that wicking action of the floating aquatic vegetation. And the loss of water in the system during acute periods, and particularly the filtering of that water so that what's evaporating is the purest fresh water in the system, because the hyacinth is actually a giant filtering mechanism. So it is that is most disturbing and growing most rapidly. Now, of course, those aquatic weeds have lots of other problems associated with them, reducing dissolved oxygen, reducing fish passage, lots of other reasons that we want to get rid of that. But that's kind of the way these needs stack.
Is it fair to say that the invasive weeds are more invasive and fastest growing when there's less water, or that's not a true fact?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I don't think I understood it, Maria.
My question was like the invasive weeds, is it fair to say that they grow faster in less water when there is less water and is warmer, or that's not a factor?
So it's not a factor in the Delta because water levels are pretty constant, obviously, because it's a tidal system. Clearly the problem is acute during the summertime. That's when we have our shortages. That's when we have the most demand on the system for agriculture. So yes, they react to warm water, long days with lots of sunlight. They've always got enough water to process through their filtration system. So it is a summertime scourge. In the wintertime, when we get cold winters, when we get freeze, all of the stuff that you see there in green will freeze, turn brown, and if we've got big flows, it'll be flushed out into the salty area. It'll die, it'll give up its fresh water, and it won't be so much of a problem. When we have warmer winters that don't get to full freeze, or when we don't get flushing flows, you get what you saw in a prior slide, which is the leftover residue from last year, which becomes essentially the seed bed to start propagating hyacinth more rapidly. So the slide there, bottom right, the brown stuff near the camera is last year's residue. And you can see this year's supply is propagating in that and then breaking loose and floating out.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So a couple of slides forward now. this is non-crop water use. There is some domestic use in the Delta. Much of the interior Delta supply is much of the interior Delta supply is from groundwater, from wells that are cased 175 or 200 feet in some cases. But there is some domestic supply. The picture there of the city of downtown Stockton, Stockton does have a straw in the Delta, withdraws water from the Delta, treats it, and serves it to its customers within the city. Another non-direct crop use is salt leaching. So what happens is in the summertime, the Delta can be a salt sink, can acquire a lot of the salt that it flows in and through the Delta, either from saltwater intrusion or from recirculation of salts that accrue to the system through irrigation in the primarily the San Joaquin Valley. In the off-season, that salt gets leached often through rainfall or high winter flows. But sometimes when we have dry winters, farmers will capture water from the channels, fresh water from the channels, and use it to actually leach the salt out of their system. That's hard to measure and manage until we develop a system for doing that that involves the cooperation of farmers in the Delta who are carrying on these activities. Also off-season, that is off the dry season, growing season, we have certain ecosystem functions that increase their demand. A good example of this upstream is rice decomp that's going on now, so that farmers are taking water off the main stem of the Sacramento River, using it to flood their rice fields, decompose the rice, and also create habitat for the Pacific flyway. So we have a lot of flood up. We have a lot of managed wetlands. And the picture at the lower part of this is a managed duck club on Holland Tract in Contra Costa County in the Delta. And then finally, we've got gain from and loss to groundwater. And this happens impossible to measure, but in general, in dry periods, we may have water leaving the Delta channels to replenish groundwater supply. And at other times, there could be groundwater that replenishes the surface supply. And obviously, this is most observable in the Delta islands that are significantly subsided and where the growing field is below the outside water table. So next slide. After you look at what the crop uses are, at the current time, we don't have to worry about accounting for operable storage. That is, taking water out of the system at one time to use it on a deferred basis in the Delta at another time. Clearly, we have exports from the Delta, and we have withdrawals from the Delta that go to storage. But that storage currently is used for demands that are outside on the fringes away from the Delta itself. So when we think about measuring and understanding water use in the Delta, at this point, we don't need to worry about reservoir storage as an impact. In the future, we may. For instance, if we see some of the expansion of groundwater and surface water storage projects, it is possible that to the extent that there is shortage in the Delta, people will take advantage of the opportunity to withdraw when their water rights are in priority, put it into storage so as to be able to return it for their use in the Delta. But that's one reason why it's important now to get a better handle on what actual Delta water use is, because we don't have to take this into account as we may at a point in the future. Next slide. So after we talk about the uses of water supply in the Delta, we turn to how that water supply is made available for whatever the use is, whether it's domestic use, crop ET, or et cetera. So the first and most important is what's called here active diversion. That's appropriation of the surface water supply. And the picture below is from Staten Island. That's a typical in-Delta diversion structure. It's a siphon. So the water level in the channel on the left-hand side is higher than the growing field that you see on the interior part of this island. So this is a siphon. You get the siphon to flow, and it flows by gravity from the higher water level outside to the interior growing level. Now, obviously, the crop ETs is a portion of that, but a portion of that also runs off as drainage water. Throughout the delta, that drainage water is captured, and typically it's destined to be pumped off the island back into the surrounding channel. But as it's working its way down that tailwater system, often that water is recaptured and used for irrigation. So when you're thinking about crop ET on Staten Island here, for instance, you can measure, as this diversion does measure, that equipment on the water side of the levee there is powering a meter to measure the amount of water that's coming through that diversion structure onto the growing field. But that water accounts for not just one time through, but also capture the tailwater and reapplication. So farm water management is an important part of understanding how water supply is actually used in the delta. In addition, the next bullet point, passive diversion or seepage, you can see that water will seep through that levee, through the riprap, and into the interior delta. That seepage is not susceptible to appropriate or accurate measurement. It's just happening all the time. You can get a bit of a handle on it by comparing water in through the diversion with water out through the drain pumps. So there are places where we're working on that with cooperation of farmers in the delta, particularly on large islands that are held in single ownership. And then finally, precipitation doesn't make such a difference in our dry summers, but can affect, for instance, leaching and soil moisture content. But luckily, I don't have to worry about allocating precipitation. That is done way above my my pay scale by almighty hands. So next, after this slide, please. When you think about how water is diverted, you also then have to look at what's the right that supports that diversion. So for a variety of reasons that I'll talk about in a little bit more detail in a later slide, riparian claims within the delta have come to be the dominant basis for lawful diversion of water for crop ET. We also have a smattering, but it's becoming a much less common smattering of pre-1914 claims that were grandfathered into our water management system in 1914 when the Water Commission was set up. Basically, the legislature said, if you've perfected a priority application of water supplies, it's grandfathered, it's outside the administration system. And then we moved after 1914 to the next bullet point of licenses, where the Water Commission, the the predecessor of the State Water Resource Control Board, began to grant licenses for water diversion and use within the delta. And then there are miscellaneous claims, claims to salvage water, claims to overlying groundwater rights, and other unspecified statutory and some specious claims. In any case, all these are claimed one place or another, one time or another, as the basis for making diversions primarily for crop ET. Next slide, please. As I mentioned before, all of this matters really only when you come to shortage. And then it really matters. It's like breathing. You take it for granted, but if you can't get your next breath, it's the only thing that counts. So in times of shortage is why we care about all these. What are the uses? Which are manageable? How are they managed? Who's got the rights? How do you manage when the system tightens down? And that's why we spend so much effort planning for the next drought, planning for shortage. So since the last drought, one of the important things that's happened is the Third District Court of Appeals came up with a final decision at the appellate level in the Tanaka case, which I've mentioned before, which is about 10 years in the litigation process. And just in August, the Supreme Court refused to review the case and so made the Third District Court of Appeals decision the final unappealable published precedential decision, which is very helpful in my role administering water rights in the Delta, because it is a fresh look at what are the principles behind supporting a claim for riparian water right. And we are currently involved with negotiations, private confidential negotiations, to settle a number of enforcement actions based on applying the principles enunciated by the Tanaka court. And we announced the first of those settlements last Friday. I'm hopeful we'll be able to announce another one this coming Friday, tomorrow. And we're hoping that there are several more that we can settle without going to hearing by applying the principles of the Tanaka decision to the individual facts of these enforcement cases. While we do that, and recognize that riparian rights are the dominant rights in the Delta, we're also looking at applying where we can the principles in our overlap memo. Those principles generally stand for the proposition that if you've got an adequate riparian supply, adequate to meet all beneficial needs on your property, you don't have a basis for claiming an alternative or overlapping or additional pre-14 water right. So getting a better handle on the basis for the diversions. In addition, we're focused, next bullet point, on QAQC of the water use information that's reported to us. And we're going into phase two of our duplicate reporting project. So I mentioned the last time I was with you that we had identified the problem. We had developed a first stage problem statement with help from our colleagues and constituents in the Delta. And we're now moving, and then we took time out because everybody had to get their reports in. And we're now going into phase two, where we're going to try and develop an agreed upon way of avoiding overlapped and duplicate reporting so that we get a more accurate indication of what water use actually is, rather than what we've had in the past, where the same water use for the same purpose, often drawn through the same point of diversion, is accounted for in two different places. One in the report of licensee for the license that may provide a basis for diverting water onto a whole island. And at the same, and at a later time in July, you get statements of diversion use where the individual landowners and individual water rights claimants report the same water. We're trying to squeeze that duplicate reporting out of the system to give us, again, a better sense for what actual water demand in the Delta is. And yet, at the end of all of this, as Delta Water Master, responsible for administering water rights in the Delta, I have to live, as we all have to live, with inherent inconsistencies in the shortage allocation systems that the legislature has given us. So on the one hand, you've got the riparian system that came to us when California became a state and the early legislature adopted the common law of England. And that common law includes the law of riparianism. And at a later point, primarily in response to the priority demands of the upstream miners, we got an overlay of a riparian priority, overlay on the riparian system of a priority allocation system. And that's first in time, first in right, which means that these two systems, which are overlaying on each other, are now coming into conflict in times of shortage, particularly in the Delta, where you've got both appropriative claims under licenses and some pre-14 claims and riparian claims. and they share shortage on a different basis. The riparians on a correlative basis, the priorities in order of their priority. So what we've got is a system that allocates shortage in the same geographic area from the same watershed in two different fashions that are incompatible. So I just want to mention that so you have a little sympathy for the difficulty that your water master faces. Let's go on to the next point, though. Next slide. What are the takeaways from this? One is that particularly in light of Tanaka and in light of the unique history of the Delta, it is riparian rights that are the most prevalent rights in the Delta. Now, riparians have the ability under common law to withdraw only certain kinds of water, potentially or specifically natural flows in the water course to which their property is adjacent. However, in the Delta, there's lots of different kinds of water mixing. There's natural flow. There's also previously stored water that has been released for a specific use. Riparians don't, under common law, have a right to that. You've also got return flows from prior appropriations that riparians don't have a right to. And yet in the Delta, when a riparian stands on his, her, or its levee and looks down, sees water, there's no good way to differentiate among them. And there's case law in the state of California that suggests if you commingle water, you've got to deal with the consequences. So to the extent that there is water commingled in these channels to which a riparian does not have a common law right, it may be, as recent cases have indicated, that there is no way to enforce against a riparian who in good faith takes water out of the channel because an enforcer like the Delta Watermaster cannot differentiate and say you took some water to which you were not entitled. That's a second takeaway. The third takeaway is the apparent overreporting of actual water use. And this is important. First of all, there had been not only the duplicate reporting that I've just described, but also you had people who were reporting high estimates. And for a good reason, they feared a day when all water rights would be cut back on a percentage basis. So they wanted to report a high amount of water use so that they could justify the amount they needed, even in terms of a cutback. And we've seen precisely that judicial response in adjudications of groundwater basins. So it's not a silly or unfounded concern. But the result of that is that we have significant over-reporting of actual water use, which we're now trying to get down to. And the fourth takeaway here is the challenge of administering in times of shortage curtailment, particularly because of the over-reporting of water use in the past, and because of the duplicate reporting, and because of the inconsistency of the shortage allocation system. And then finally, I think a good takeaway from our work here is that there is actually less variability in water use in the Delta than we have heretofore thought. We thought there was more variability between wet years and dry years, and there's lower volume than we've formerly estimated. And that has real world consequences because those estimates find their way into models. We use the models to manage within the system. So this is an important effort. And that's why I wanted to take a deep dive on talking to you about the intricacies of identifying and getting a consistent set of data that are widely respected and agreed to be credible so that we can begin to move off of arguments about what's happening and get into the discussion of what should we do about it. So again, I'm going to take a quick stop here, take a breath in case anybody wants to ask questions about this portion of the deep dive.
Are there any questions from the council members?
Okay, hearing none, can I have the next slide? So this is the other thing that we're going to take a bit of a deep dive on, the state policy of reduced reliance on water supply from the Delta. Next slide, please. So you've all seen this, but permit me, if I can, to read this because it is the policy of the state of California to reduce reliance on the Delta in meeting California's future water supply needs through a statewide strategy of investing in improved regional supplies, conservation, and water use efficiency. Each region that depends on water from the Delta watershed shall improve its regional self-reliance for water through investment in water use efficiency, water recycling, advanced water technologies, local and regional water supply projects, and improved regional coordination of local and regional water supply efforts. Very clear, very straightforward state policy. Next slide, please. But with many things, it's harder when you start to think about how it gets actually implemented. So one thing we have to take account of is the extensive variability and volatility of the Delta water supply. That volatility we've seen in these head-snapping juxtapositions of drought and flood. And so we think in terms of managing within the Delta for what's come to be called the big gulp, little sip strategy. When there's lots of water in the system, you can take a lot of water out of it without any risk, without hurting other water users, without hurting the environment. And you might do that so that you can put that water aside so that in times of shortage, you can be satisfied with the little sip. So that's, kind of an overall strategy that we've talked about in the Delta to deal with this variability, this volatility, which we recognize is likely to increase as a result of climate change. But in applying this strategy for managing a highly variable and volatile system, we need to take account of the different challenges faced by urban and ag users in dealing with that extreme variability of supply. So I've just listed four of them. Affordability on an acre-foot basis is obviously higher for urban users than ag users. The ag users with the migration to permanent crops have permanent hardened demand. They can't simply say, we won't grow tomatoes this year because we don't have enough water supply, when they've already committed that former tomato field to vines or almond trees, which if you don't water them this year, will be dead by next year. So the demand is hardened, and it occurs precisely during the warm summer months when shortages are likely to be most acute. In addition, both ag and urban users are facing real problems with deferred maintenance and loss of functionality in infrastructure across the board. And again, urbans are in a far better position to organize themselves, as they have with respect to reduced reliance, to increase their stormwater capture, to increase south of Delta storage, thinking of things like Diamond Valley Reservoir, increasing their use of groundwater storage, becoming involved in asymmetric water trades with agricultural water users, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, desalination, significant programs for conservation and reduced demand. So all of those things are differentially available or affordable on the urban side compared to the ag side. And that, folks, that relates directly to the differential availability of revenue streams to support it. So what are the implications of that? If I can have the next slide. People are looking at the Delta and trying to figure out what reduced reliance means to them. And I categorize these here as, what can we do to improve the management of what we've got, or improve how we use the Delta for all these various uses that I've talked about. A lot of work going in now to how do we avoid the costs associated with improved management or reduced reliance? And then what are the temptations for what I call chasing the chimera of squeezing more water out of the Delta for use somewhere else? And I bring this up because there have been a number of recent cases and contexts where that straightforward policy of reduced reliance has come into actual focus in implementation. One is in how we manage, how we migrate to improved real-time management of operating the systems that we've already got. Better SCADA systems, better real-time analysis of what's going on in the ecosystem, improved measurement of diversion and use throughout the entire watershed and the export community that relies on it. So some of that has been contentious. Think about the lawsuits that are going on over the new biological opinions or the incidental take permit, those regulatory efforts to constrain and manage so as to avoid damage in project operations. And I don't just mean the export project operations. I mean all the operations where we try and manage water supplies within the watershed. So there's good, creative stuff that's going on there, but some conflict about how that change in project operations is going to affect the system. We're also involved, obviously, in consideration of dual conveyance, alternative conveyance, which the Delta Plan has endorsed in concept. And now we've got a design construction authority trying to figure out what the best way to accomplish that objective is. Again, highly controversial and undoubtedly subject to a lot of pushback and, as is almost inevitable, litigation. The third bullet point here is about the San Joaquin Valley Blueprint. I'm a big supporter of the San Joaquin Valley Blueprint. It's an effort to bring together all the water users in the San Joaquin Valley and say, we've got a big change coming to the valley in terms of sustainable groundwater management implementation, which we know is going to, over time and on a up and down basis, it's going to reduce an average over diversion of water from the groundwater aquifers of about 2.5 million acre feet per year. So as they think within this broad-based blueprint about what they can do to come to grips with that reduction of 2.5 million acre feet on average over time, they're looking at a lot of San Joaquin Valley infrastructure improvements, getting greater supply reliability through groundwater storage, replenishing those overtaxed groundwater basins, finding the right places to do that. Lots of stuff that are kind of the no regrets activities that the San Joaquin Valley would like to do to put itself in a better position to deal with the reduction of groundwater that's going to come through SGMA implementation. However, in addition to that, they are naturally looking to what they can do to augment the supply. And it's not unusual that they should look to the Delta and figure out, are there water supplies there that can be successfully wrung out of the Delta and used to augment San Joaquin Valley supply? I've been pretty vocal in saying that I think that is chasing a chimera by and large, because even if you look at average supplies, places where times at which there's a lot of supply in the Delta, we don't have the infrastructure to capture it at those brief and unpredictable periods of time. And the cost of that infrastructure, even if it could be permitted and even if the funds could be raised to support it and maintain it, it would be used only a few days per year and not in every year, because those big flows that make up the average of water, quote unquote, lost from the Delta come in very short periods. So I've tried to weigh in with the blueprint to suggest that they need to be careful about putting much planning into getting a significant increment of water from the Delta. I've had a similar circumstance in San Diego County, where two member agencies of the San Diego County Water Authority have proposed to their local LAFCO withdrawing from the San Diego County Water Authority so as to take water under contract from a different MET member agency. And I weighed in on that to say, LAFCO and the County Water Agency and the de-annexing agencies and the alternative metropolitan water supplier all need to take a look at that section of the state water code about reduced reliance. Because what we wouldn't want to have happen is for areas where there is significant investment in the very kinds of regional reliance and reduced reliance on the Delta, which is expensive, for instance, desalination or some of these other projects for harvesting wastewater and turning it into tap water. Those are expensive, and we need to take into account, and the users and LAFCO and others should think about, even though they're hundreds of miles from the Delta, whether their actions are in concert with the state policy of reduced reliance. And then the final point here, Orange County, the Metropolitan Water District of Orange County was gracious enough to invite me recently to speak to their membership in a virtual forum about how they should think about and what they should know about what's going on in the Delta. And because Orange County is one of the leaders in these very intelligent asymmetric water transfer transactions, multi-year transactions, in which when there's lots of water, an agency in Orange County will agree with a ag agency in the San Joaquin Valley, will say, we'll give you water this year, let's say 100 units, 100 acre feet, just to use a number. And we'll expect to get back from you in a future year, 50 acre feet, half of that. That's what I mean by an asymmetric trade. And they do it so as to manage this volatility in availability of supply. But one of the things that I mentioned to them in the forum was that you need to be careful about thinking about those asymmetric transactions because of how the demand in the Central Valley relates to the urban demand. So these are all contexts in which people are struggling with exactly how they apply this relatively simple, straightforward requirement for reduced reliance. Next slide, please. So what are the takeaways here? First of all, figuring out what reduced reliance means, you could look at it by rate. Is it how many CFS are taken out of the Delta at a moment? Is that what we're trying to reduce? Or is it overall volume? Do we allow for that variability of rate? Take a lot when there's a lot of water, take a little when there's not much water, but the volume is about the same? Or are we looking at time? Are we only caring about that increased reliance in times of shortage or in times when we can predict or expect to have shortage? Secondly, we need to evaluate what are the methods for capturing that quote-unquote excess supply. I've talked a little bit about that in an earlier slide. And then bringing it home to the Delta Plan and to the Delta Stewardship Council, the enforcement of the reduced reliance through the consistency determination process gets at that problem, except where whatever is the issue is not a covered action. Go back to that San Diego example that I referred to earlier. The de-annexation of those two agencies from San Diego and their annexation or contracting with another MET member agency is not a covered action because it doesn't take place in the Delta. But does it imply an increased reliance on the Delta supply because those two agencies will reduce their diversity of supply available through the San Diego County Water Authority in favor of a less diverse supply that at the margin probably means more Delta water going to that use. And it kind of doesn't matter whether it's even the same molecules of water, because if more of their mix is from the Delta, that means that certain other demands can't be achieved from that Delta supply. So as I say, as the Delta Water Master, I've started to bang the drum for thinking about reduced reliance as a statewide strategy, even in these very localized decision-making processes. Next slide, please. So going to adapting to climate change, one of the things that I keep thinking about is it's not likely to affect us in the Delta like the frog in the pot, where it's a degree at a time. It fills up and the frog gets cooked without feeling it or knowing it. It's more likely, as Gil Cosio and others have said earlier in today's program, it's more likely to be a black swan event, a big event that is predictable at some point, but is always a surprise when it shows up. It's the earthquake. It's the levee failure. It's the flood. It's the storm surge with a king tide. It's that thing that happens, the confluence of events that impacts us or overwhelms us. And so as we think about our traditional process of planning for the next drought, planning for the next shortage condition, we really need to be thinking about climate change in both of these areas. The gradual increment of sea level, the change in our precipitation patterns, the volatility, but also these black swan events. Next slide, please. So, conclusions. For all of these things, whether it's the work plan, whether it's the deep dives that we've taken, capturing, presenting, and using credible and accessible data is job one. That's important to inform the operational flexibility that we need. We clearly need to use our infrastructure better, more intensively, but more wisely based on what we're monitoring, what we understand, and shared understanding of what the data are. So that's why we're spending so much time within the Office of the Delta Watermaster focusing on these issues on which we've taken a deep dive, because that's how we're going to be able to appropriately manage risks in the future. And importantly, in managing those risks, make trade-offs. And unfortunately, we all know that there are trade-offs in almost all the Delta management decisions we make. And because there are trade-offs, we've got constituents on either side prepared to fund their lawyers to take us into court and fight us and whoever us is. So having better data and having people understand that data and use that data should help us to argue more about what the data, how we should implement what we learn from the data, and spend less time arguing about what the data tell us. And that has the potential, at least, to reduce the friction in every decision we make, that friction of litigation, of permitting, et cetera, that constipates us in taking actions that could actually have some adaptive management benefit for the Delta. And finally, as I've said, we've got to do this all in a context where we're facing the dual challenges of the frog in the pot and the black swan event presented by climate change. So next slide. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I am very mindful, Chair Tutayan, that I have probably overstayed my welcome by a little bit, so I won't be offended if you ask me to get off the stage and move along.
Thank you, Michael. Council members, any questions for Michael George? Well, thank you, Michael. I'm amazed at your capacity to not only pay attention to what's happening in the Delta and the Delta watershed, but even down in San Diego. Thank you for being an excellent water master for the Delta.
Well, thank you, Chair Tutayan. And let me say, I really do appreciate the attention of the council and the interactions with your staff that is the only way that I can do an effective job as Delta Water Master. So thank you very much. And I look forward to giving you updates in the next quarter. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
So is there any... public. Oh yes, go ahead. Is that Oscar?
No, I just wanted to say thank you to Michael as well. I mean, he's such a just a massive amount of knowledge about these challenges, and he finds a way to kind of crystallize them and kind of place them into layman's terms, and they're very complicated. And so I wanted to say thank you, Michael, because it's incredibly important, and your work is not going unnoticed. So thank you.
Yes.
There's one public.
Other. Go ahead, Lita.
Sorry, we're all talking over each other on accident. There's one public comment from OSHA Missouri. OSHA, would you like to unmute yourself?
Just 1 second. Let me move her over.
Oh, sorry, Brandon. I didn't know you were.
Okay, she should be able to now.
Okay.
Hi, if there was no more council member comments, didn't want to get in the way of that. OSHA Missouri for local agencies of the North Delta. Appreciate the detailed presentation by the Water Master as well. Just had a couple of follow-up comments to some of that content. First of all, Council Member Moranian asked about the weeds and, you know, whether water flows made a difference. And I think toward the end of Mr. George's answer, it got to what I think is the answer, which is yes. Aquatic weeds do get flushed out by higher flows. And when flows are low or in dead end areas, the weeds tend to be worse. So certainly in the council's thinking around this issue, which is identified as an action item in the water resiliency portfolio report under 12.2 to manage invasive weeds. Certainly, you know, I think flows are one of the things, among others, that need to be addressed to try to address weeds. In addition, I kind of throw harmful algal blooms under this weed heading as well, which obviously are very impacted by flows, and flows are one of the best ways to minimize algal blooms as well. With respect to the points about groundwater and depletions onto the islands, I just wanted to point out that if river levels are lowered, for instance, from large diversions on the Sacramento River, that also reduces groundwater recharge to the South American subbasin as well as the Eastern San Joaquin subbasin. And extensive evidence was presented about this problem in the Water Fix water rights hearings a couple of years ago, prior to the petition being withdrawn by DWR and the Bureau. So I just want to flag, because I know there's, you know, talk of integration and trying to take a big picture approach with the council. And I think integration with SGMA is going to require that with the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is going to require taking a look at these issues about how large diversions could also impact our ability to reach sustainability, for instance, in the South American subbasin, which is in the process of preparing its groundwater sustainability plan, because the Sacramento River is a losing reach in that area and actually helps recharge the subbasin. And so this is kind of yet another driver for implementing that policy of reduced reliance. Couple areas where just want to point out, you know, push back a little bit on a couple of the statements by the Water Master. I think, you know, Delta water users, from my perspective, don't agree with the theory that there cannot be overlapping rights. And I think that's an ongoing discussion that, you know, lawyers and others are having about what the water rights system of California allows and what's appropriate. Certainly all the water users know that we should not be double reporting and we cannot be double using. And of course, Delta water users don't have anywhere to put water that they can't use. And then of course, everyone's subject to reasonable use. So I hope to, you know, make progress on that discussion and come to, you know, a good place with the Water Master on how to make sure that the databases are accurate and helpful. But at the same time, not undermine the senior water rights that come in a few different forms for Delta water users. And then just last, to touch on the San Joaquin Valley blueprint, you know, I have not been part of that process. Delta stakeholders are not part of that process and have not been invited to participate. I would say, you know, I do have some quite a large concern about the blueprint seems to intend to make up a 2.5 million acre foot overdraft of groundwater in the South San Joaquin Valley with increased water deliveries from the Delta potentially. And some of the, you know, there's very little publicly available information about what this blueprint might look like, but they do indicate that they're interested in the idea of exporting an additional 2.2 million acre feet per year by, you know, making more aggressive exports from the Delta. So I just want to flag for the council and others that there is controversy around the approach in the blueprint. I think there's probably a lot of parts of it that there probably is, you know, widespread interest and buy-in in, but to the extent that the blueprint kind of robs Peter to pay Paul in terms of taking fresh water out of the Delta to try to make up for a problem with groundwater recharge, you know, I don't think that is sustainable. And that's probably something that will have to get worked out in the Sigma implementation years, you know, about whether that in fact could be sustainable to, you know, impact one, you know, to take surface water from one area and create sustainability to groundwater and surface water impacts in that area in order to try to, you know, improve groundwater levels in another region. So thank you.
Right. Thank you, OSHA. Well, if there are no other comments from the council and no public comments, we can move on to public comment in general on any items not on the agenda.
There's no general public comment.
Okay, thank you, Lita. Then we will conclude with the note that the next council meeting is November 19, 2020, again via teleconference. Know that this is a week earlier than usual due to the Thanksgiving holiday. And a quick reminder that the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting will take place remotely on Monday from 1 to 3 p.m. And for more information, go to deltacouncil.ca.gov. It'll be on our website. With that, thank you all for attending. Be safe, take care, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.